Rough Rider was the private code for Rudolf Zederberg, Ralph's chief rival in the transport business. Zederberg's express coaches plied from Delagoa to Algoa Bay, from the goldfields of Pilgrim's Rest to Witwatersrand, to the railhead at Kimberley. While his telegraph operator tapped it out on the brass and teak instrument, Ralph turned back to his engineer. "All right. What were the snags that held you up, and how can we beat them?"
The worst is the bottleneck at Kimberley shunting yards. For an hour they worked, and at the end of it, the locomotive whistled outside the shack. They went out, still arguing and planning. Ralph tossed his saddlebag and blanket roll onto the first flat car and held the train for 10 minutes longer while he arranged the final details with his engineer.
"From now on you will get your hardware faster than you can nail it down," he promised grimly, as he vaulted up onto the bogey and waved at the driver.
The whistle sent a jet of steam spurting into the dry desert air, and the locomotive wheel spun and then gripped with a jolt, and the long string of empty cars began to trundle southwards, building up speed rapidly. Ralph found a corner of the truck out of the wind and rolled into his blanket. 8 days' ride from the Lupani River to the railhead. It had to be some sort of record.
"But there's no prize for that either," he grinned wearily,
pulled his hat over his eyes, and settled down to listen to the song of the wheels over the ties. "We have got to hurry, we have got to hurry, we have got to hurry." And then, just before he fell asleep, the song changed. "The cattle are dying, the cattle are dying, the cattle are dying," sang the wheels over and over and over again. But even that could not keep him awake 1 second longer. They pulled into the shunting yards at Kimberley 16 hours later. It was just past 4 in the morning. Ralph jumped down off the bogey as the locomotive slowed for the points, and with his saddlebag slung over his shoulder, trudged up the De Beers Road. There was a light on in the telegraph office, and Ralph beat on the wooden hatch until the night operator peered out at him, like a barn owl from its nest.
"I want to send an urgent telegraph to Bulawayo."
"Sorry, mate, the line's down."
"When will it be open again?"
"God knows. It's been out for 6 days already." Ralph was still grinning as he swaggered into the lobby of the Diamond Lil Hotel. The night clerk was new. He did not recognize Ralph. He saw a tall, lean, sunburned man whose stained and dusty clothing hung loosely on him. That wild ride had burned off all Ralph's excess flesh. He had not shaved since leaving the Lupani, and his boots were scuffed almost through the uppers by the brushing of the thorn scrub as he had ridden through it. Locomotive soot had darkened his face and reddened his eyes, and the clerk recognized a drifter when he saw one.
"I am sorry, sir," he said. "The hotel is full." "Who's in the Blue Diamond suite?" Ralph asked affably.
"Sir Randolph Charles," the clerk's voice was filled with reverence.
"Get him out," said Ralph.
"I beg your pardon." The clerk reared back, and his expression was frosty. Ralph reached across the desk and took him by his watered silk cravat and drew him closer.
"Get him out of my suite," Ralph repeated,
his lips an inch from the man's ear. "Quickly." It was at that moment that the day clerk came into the reception office. "Mr. Ballantyne," he cried with a mixture of alarm and feigned pleasure, as he rushed to the rescue of his colleague, "your permanent suite will be ready in a minute." Then he hissed in the night clerk's other ear, "Clear that suite immediately, or he'll do it for you." The Blue Diamond had one of the very few bathrooms in Kimberley with laid-on hot water. 2 black servants stoked the boiler outside the window to keep steam whistling from the valve, while Ralph lay chin-deep and adjusted a trickle of scalding water with his big toe on the tap. At the same time, he shaved his jaws with a straight razor, working by touch and scorning the mirror. The day clerk had supervised the removal of Ralph's steamer trunk from the box-room, and hovered over the valets as they pressed the suits and tried to improve upon the perfect shine of the boots that they unpacked from the trunk. At 5 minutes before noon, Ralph, smelling of brilliantine and eau de cologne, marched into Aaron Fagan's office. Aaron was a thin, stooped man with threadbare hair brushed straight back from a deep intellectual forehead. His nose was beaked, his mouth full and sensitive, and his slow eyes aware and bright. He played a cruel game of Calabrias, giving no quarter. And yet there was a compassionate streak in his nature, which Ralph valued as highly as any of his other qualities. If he had known what Ralph intended at this moment, he would have tried to dissuade him. But after having put the case against it, he would then have gone ahead and drawn up a contract as mercilessly as he would have elevated his Jas and Menel for a winning coup at Calabrias. Ralph didn't have time to argue ethics with him now, so as they embraced and patted each other's shoulder blades affectionately, he forestalled the question by asking, "Are they here?" and then pushing open the door to the inner office. Rulof and Dul Zederberg did not rise as he entered, and neither they nor Ralph made any attempt to shake hands. They had clashed viciously, but indecisively, on too many occasions.
"So, Ballantyne, you want to waste our time again?"
Rulof's accent was still thick with his Swedish ancestry, but under his pale ginger brows, his eyes were quick with interest.
"My dear Rulof," Ralph protested, "I would never do that. All I want is that we should resolve this tariff on the new Matabeleland route before we put each other out of business."
"Ja," Dole agreed sarcastically, "that is a good thought. Like my mother-in-law should love me."
"We are willing to listen for a few minutes anyway." Rulof's tone was casual, but his interest was quicker still.
"One of us should buy the other out and set his own tariffs," said Rolf blandly.
And the brothers glanced at each other involuntarily. Rulof made a fuss of relighting his dead cigar to hide his astonishment.
"You are asking yourselves why," Ralph said. "You want to know why Ralph Ballantyne wants to sell out?"
Neither brother denied it. They waited quietly as vultures in the treetops.
"The truth is, I have overextended myself in Matabeleland. The Harkness mine..."
The lines of tension around Rulof's mouth smoothed out.
"They had heard about the mine. The talk on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange floor was that it would cost £50,000 to bring it into production.
I am behind on the railway contract for Mr. Rhodes," Ralph went on quietly and seriously. "I need cash."
"You had a figure in mind?" Rulof asked, and took a puff on the cigar.
Ralph nodded and gave it to him, and Rulof choked on his smoke. His brother pounded him between his shoulders until he regained his breath, and then Rulof chuckled and shook his head.
"Ja," he said, "that is good, that is very good one."
"It looks as though you were right," Ralph agreed. "I am wasting your time."
He pushed back his chair and stood up.
"Sit down," Rulof stopped laughing. "Sit down and let's talk," he said briskly.
And by the following noon, Aaron Fagan had drawn up the contract in his own hand. It was very simple. The purchasers accepted the attached statement of assets as complete and correct. They agreed to take over all existing contracts of carriage and the responsibility of all goods at present in transit. The seller gave no guarantees. The purchase price was in cash. No share transfers were involved. And the effective date was that of the signatures. Walk out, walk in. They signed in the presence of their attorneys, and then both parties, accompanied by their legal counsellors, crossed the street to the main branch of the Dominion Colonial and Overseas Bank, where the cheque of Zederberg Brothers was presented and duly honoured by the manager. Ralph swept the bundles of £5 notes into his carpet bag, tipped his hat to the brothers Zederberg.
"Good luck to you, gentlemen."
And then he took Aaron Fagan's arm and led him in the direction of Diamond Lil's hotel. Rulof Zederberg massaged the bald spot on his crown.
"I suddenly have this strange feeling," he murmured uneasily, as he watched them go.
The next morning, Ralph left Aaron Fagan at the door of his office.
"You'll be hearing from the good brothers Zederberg again, sooner than you expect," he warned him affably. "Try not to bother me with their accusations, there's a good fellow."
He sauntered away across the market square, leaving Aaron staring after him thoughtfully. Ralph's progress was slow. Half a dozen acquaintances stopped him to inquire solicitously after his health, and then seek confirmation of the sale of his transport company,
or to find out if he intended making a public issue of Harkness Mine shares. Give me a nod when you decide, Ralph. Any help I can give, it'll be my pleasure, Mr. Ballantyne. Rumours of the payable values of the Harkness ore had put it as high as 60 ounces to the ton, and everybody he met wanted to be let in. So it took him almost an hour to cover the 500 yards to the offices of the De Beers Consolidated Mines Company. It was a magnificent edifice, a temple dedicated to the worship of diamonds. The open balconies on all three floors were laced with white grills of delicate ironwork. The walls were of red brick, with corners picked out in worked stone blocks. The windows were of stained glass, and the doors were oiled teak, with polished brass fittings. Ralph signed his name in the visitor's book, and a uniformed janitor with white gloves led him up the spiral staircase to the top floor. There was a brass plate on the teak door, a name only, with no title to accompany it. Mr. Jordan Ballantyne. But the grandeur of the office beyond the door gave some indication of Jordan's importance in the hierarchy of De Beers Diamond Company. The double windows looked out over the Kimberley mine. The excavation was almost a mile across, and it was impossible, even from this height, to see into its depth. It seemed as though a meteor had struck and ploughed this crater through the earth's crust. Each day saw it driven deeper and deeper still, as the miners followed the fabulous cone of blue kimberlite conglomerate downwards. Already that hole had delivered up almost 10 million carats of fine diamonds, and Mr. Rhodes's company owned it all. Ralph merely glanced once at this view of the pit, in which he had spent most of his youth grovelling and scratching for the elusive stones, and then he surveyed the room appraisingly. The panelling was of seasoned oak, the intricate carving worked by craftsmen. The carpets over the floor were silk coom, and the books in the shelves were matching sets bound in Morocco and stamped in gold leaf. There was the sound of running water from the open door of the bathroom, and a voice asked, "Who is it?" Ralph spun his hat onto the stand and turned to face the door as Jordan came through it. He was in his shirt sleeves with protectors over his cuffs. His shirt was the finest Irish linen, and the cravat under his stock was watered silk. He was drying his hands on a monogrammed towel, but he froze when he saw Ralph. Then he threw the towel aside and crossed to him with three long, lithe strides and a cry of delight. At last Ralph broke the brotherly embrace and held Jordan off at arm's length to study him. "Always the dandy," Ralph teased him, and ruffled his thick, fashionably dressed golden curls. No amount of brotherly familiarity could dim the fact that Jordan was still one of the most handsome men that Ralph had ever met. No, he was more than handsome. He was beautiful. And his evident pleasure at seeing Ralph heightened the glow of his skin and the lively sparkle of green behind his long, curved fringe of lashes. As always, his younger brother's charisma and gentle nature recaptivated Ralph. "And you," Jordan laughed, "you look so hard and brown and lean. What on earth happened to that prosperous paunch?"
"I left it on the road from Matabeleland."
"Matabeleland?" Jordan's expression changed. "Then you'll have brought the terrible news with you." Jordan hurried to the leather-topped desk.
"The telegraph line has been down for over a week. This is the first message to come through. I finished decoding it not an hour ago."
He handed Ralph the flimsy, and he scanned it swiftly. The translation was written in Jordan's fair hand between the lines of teleprinting. The addressee was Jove, Mr. Rhodes's private code name, and it was from General Mungo St. John, in his capacity as acting administrator of Matabeleland, in the absence of Dr. Jamieson.